I will say to you once again, I've already quoted this week a statement the Lord made in the 13th chapter of Matthew, verse 62, that I said I've tried to use as a guideline most of the years I've been preaching. Here the Son of God tells us that every scribe, that means every student that's instructed in the kingdom of heaven, is like a man that's a householder that brings out of his treasure things both new and old. This is the Lord's way of telling us that a faithful scribe, student of the Word of God, or minister of the Word of God, will be identified by some of these characteristics, that he will bring forth to God's people a combination of things that are both new and old. And I said many times to God's people, and I've said it to you, and I'll probably say it again, that it's my firm belief that a gospel sermon ought to be made up of enough old familiar things that Bible readers can say, I know something about that, I'm familiar with that, I'm not lost when it comes to that. And yet at the same time, we should be able to grow in grace and in the knowledge of the truth, that we could learn some new things and our minds be stimulated and grow. I have found by experience that there's things that I preached on maybe 25 or 30 years ago and have not had an impression to preach on for maybe many years, that sometimes this impression comes again. And I have found that while Bible doctrine does not change, I preach the same Bible doctrine and the same Bible truth. Bible doctrine and Bible truth does not change. Yet our experience in life changes and our viewpoint of life changes. A 30-year-old preacher does not deliver a sermon like a 60-year-old preacher. Now, a 30-year-old preacher will preach Bible truth and Bible doctrine, and maybe in his 60s will preach the same Bible truth and Bible doctrine. And I say to God's people many times, when it comes to Bible doctrines, if I'm wrong, I started out wrong, I can at least claim consistency. Yet at the same time, as we go through life, I think many of you folk here have realized already that our viewpoints of life change, our experience change, and our views of life change. One of my favorite stories that I tell God's people to illustrate this is in some papers I have at home that was written by a very fine old preacher, a very honorable, godly man of another order of people. When he was up in his 80s, he wrote that said back when he was a 25-year-old preacher, single, of course had no children, 25-year-old preacher, he wrote a little booklet on 10 commandments for bringing up children. After he married and had a family of his own, when he was in his 50s, he rewrote the book, but he gave it another title. The new title was 10 Suggestions for Bringing Up Children. I think you're catching on. If he'd lived to be 75, he might have given it another title, 10 Hints for Bringing Up Children. Now then, the point I want you to see in that is as a 25-year-old man who had never been married, never tried to bring up a family, he could write a book called 10 Commandments for Bringing Up Children. Try this. It'll work. After he'd been married about 25 years, had children, tried to bring some up, he sort of waters down the title a little bit. Try this. Maybe it'll work. You know, 10 Suggestions for Bringing Up Children. So sometimes our view of life changes, and our perspective changes, and also the Lord enriches our experience. I want to go this morning to what's on my mind. I've said to God's people many times, I have a severe handicap in preaching. I have to preach what's on my mind. I want to go to some things I used to preach on from time to time back when I was much younger. If I preach on them today, the Bible doctrine and Bible truth I preach will be the same. If I preach on them today, it will have to be with whatever light and liberty and leadership the Lord gives me today. Whatever light and liberty I had in years past, of course, was for that occasion. But if I preach on them today, I will have to preach on them based on some experiences and things I've had with these things, these verses in recent years. We come to the 30th chapter of Proverbs, and Solomon, who learned much of what he wrote in the Bible and what he learned in life, learned it by observation. Solomon tells us in the 30th chapter of Proverbs, verse 24, he says, there's four things upon earth. He says, they are very little, but they're exceeding wise. Then Solomon begins to deal with some things here that has endless sermons in it. Any preacher of the gospel could pick up any one of these items and spend a great deal of time on the things Solomon is going to name in the following verses. You could preach dozens of sermons from this, and no two of the sermons be the same. And my Uncle Ray Piles used to say time and time again, he'd say, I'd rather hear a preacher take the same text and preach several different sermons from it than to hear a preacher just take a different text every time and preach the same sermon. And a lot of that is done also. And I agree with my uncle, I'd rather hear a preacher be able to take one particular topic in the Bible, develop it into several different sermons, as to just change the heading or the text every once in a while and be preaching basically the same sermon. But we come to the 30th chapter of Proverbs, and he says there's four things on earth. He says they're very small, they're exceeding small, but he says they're exceeding wise. The first that he names is the ant. He says the ants are a people not strong, but he says yet they prepare their meat in the summer. The ants are a people not strong. And he goes on and names the ant. He tells us here that the ant is small, but it's one of these four things that he says is exceeding wise. Then Solomon will also tell us that the locusts have no king, yet they go forth all of them together by bands. Then he will mention, he says, the conies are a feeble folk. And from what I've been able to study about the coney was a little creature that lived in that part of the world. The coney was, best way I could describe it, was sort of a cross between a rabbit and a fox. Rather small creature here, did not have fangs and claws, and was not really equipped to fight. Conies, he says here, the conies are rather feeble folk, sort of half rabbit, half fox, and he says they make their habitation in the rock. Then he names the spider, and he says the spider taketh hold with her hands, and says she is in king's palaces. Now he tells us that there's things that we can learn by studying these four little creatures, because he says they are exceeding wise. And if it's the Lord's will, I want to talk to you this morning about some things that we can learn by studying these four things that are very small that Solomon says are exceeding wise. Apparently, Solomon spent a lot of time studying ants. He spent a lot of time studying anthills. Now, in this day and age, a lot of folks have the idea that if you're going to be smart, you've got to spend a lot of time studying encyclopedias, or you've got to spend a lot of time looking up information on the Internet. Or you've got to spend a lot of time in great big books with pretty little covers on them. But Solomon says that you can receive a lot of wisdom by studying the ant. I find in the 6th chapter of Proverbs, verse 6, where Solomon is dealing with a sluggard or a lazy person. And he tells this sluggard or lazy person, he says, go to the ant, thou sluggard, consider her ways and be wise. Now, he doesn't tell this a sluggard to go over here and take some kind of course on 10 easy lessons to become successful. He doesn't tell him to go over here and take some kind of a business course. He doesn't say to go take this seminar this fellow offers on TV and study the 7 habits of successful people. Doesn't tell him to do that at all. He doesn't tell him that you've got to take the Mary Kay training course. There's a lot of good in it. I've learned quite a bit from studying the Mary Kay training course myself. I don't sell Mary Kay. I'm sorry to disappoint you. But one thing I learned from Mary Kay is the word focus. 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 That means follow one course until successful. Because most every morning when I wake up, I've got plenty to do over here and lots to do over here and lots to do over here. And there's things swirling around about me. And about the biggest decision, hardest decision I have to make is where to start. And usually I have to start with that which is most pressing, which has a deadline to it. I have to figure out what's going to fall in today if I don't tend to it, and think in terms of priorities. And I think some of you folk know that when you've got about 15 things swirling around about you at one time, it's hard to concentrate on one thing. And lots of time I think about the Mary Kay's principle, focus, focus, focus on one thing. Follow one course until successful. You can't handle all these things at once. Get on one thing, deal with it, follow one course until successful. That's also true when God's people come out to hear the gospel. Instead of our minds wandering on things here and wandering on things there and wandering on things here, we need to focus. We're here to serve the Lord. We're here to preach, pray, and sing. We're here to attend to His Word. And this man in the pulpit must recognize that he cannot preach everything in the Bible from Genesis to Revelation. He's got to focus on one thing. follow one course until successful. So he says over here, go to the ant, thou sluggard, consider her ways and be wise. There's something in that I've got to notice. You know, I've studied ants most of my life. Out where I live, we have red ants. You may call them harvester ants. We have fire ants. We've got carpenter ants, what they call acrobat ants, all kinds of ants. I spent a lot of time studying them. But, you know, I'm not able to tell the boys from the girls. I never have made a habit of picking ants up. Never have picked ants up and put them under a microscope to try to see the difference in the boys and the girls. Yet, ant experts who've done this, they tell us that these out here that are doing the work, these that are out here doing the work are the girls. I think most everybody knows here that the ants have a civilization. You know, they have a queen. They've got soldier ants. They've got worker ants, army ants, and all this. They've got a well-organized society. But they tell me that these that you see out here doing the work are the girls. Well, how could Solomon be so sure about that? You don't suppose Solomon had traveled all over the world and picked up ants all over the world under a microscope to study stuff like this? He didn't say consider his ways. He didn't say consider its ways. He said consider her ways. These are the girls up there doing the work. Well, folks who study ants tell us he's exactly right on that. Wonder how Solomon knew that. You don't have to wonder about it. The God of heaven who made every ant in this universe, the God of heaven who made every ant in this universe inspired Solomon to put down her ways, her ways, her ways, her ways. Now then notice something else. It's the little things the Bible sometimes folks stumble over. Sometimes people are looking so hard for the hidden they don't see the obvious. Sometimes in studying the Bible, we don't see the forest for the trees. Let's go to another verse I quoted this morning. It says, the spider taketh hold with her hands. Well, Solomon had not traveled all over the world and picked up every species or type of spider on earth and put them under the microscope. I don't know how to tell the boys from the girls when it comes to spiders. And we deal with some at home, and I've seen one, some here and there. I mean, they're so small, I don't know how you could tell. But that one up there building that web is a girl. You ever hear of a black widow? We have them everywhere where I live. You know why she's called a black widow? Because her husband has a very short life expectancy. He just serves one purpose. And after he serves that purpose, that's all there is to him. You hear that? After he serves that one purpose, it's all over. That one up there built that web that's sitting there perched, hoping a grasshopper or something or a fly will land in it. That one sitting up there in that web is a girl. You say, well, wonder how Solomon knew all that. Did you catch it? He didn't write the spider taketh hold with its hands, neuter. Take a hole with his hands, masculine. He sticks his neck way out. He says, the spider take a hole with her hands. That's sticking your neck way out, Brother Solomon. Oh, no, it isn't. You haven't traveled all over the world, Solomon. You haven't been all over the world and examined every spider in the world. How do you know that? Because the God of heaven who made every spider in the world and knew all about spiders inspired Solomon to put her. Well, scientists come along later with their technology, and after we've explored a good part of the world and they've examined things like this, he's right. Well, of course he's right, because Solomon is doing this by divine inspiration. Here's one more example of the scientific accuracy of the Bible right down to the minutest detail. He says here to Proverbs chapter 6, he says, go to the ant, thou sluggard, consider her ways and be wise. He says, which having no guide, overseer, or ruler, says, provideth her meat in the summer. You say, I didn't know ants ate meat. In a King James Bible, that word meat means meal. You know, people sat at a meal, or people sat at meat, they're sitting at a meal. That's anything people eat. Back in those days, in that particular day, the word meat could involve anything you ate at a meal. He says, provideth her meat in the summer, and gathereth her food in the harvest. Now then, why is he telling us that the spider is so wise? What is it we can learn from the ant? What is it we can learn from the ant? Go to the ant, thou sluggard, consider her ways and be wise. He says, which, having no guide, overseer, or ruler, says, provideth her meat in the summer, and gathereth her, provideth her meat in the harvest, and gathereth her food in the summer. Why is it? What is it that we can learn from the spider? Back to Proverbs chapter 30, he says, there's four things on earth, they're very small, but they're exceeding wise. He says here that the ants are a people not strong. That's right. They're very easy to crush. Some of them very, very tiny. I suppose if you were to take an ant's brain, you could put it on the end of a pin head, you'd probably have to have a powerful microscope to even see it. Yet that ant with that very tiny brain has more wisdom than a lot of humans I watch. Says, this ant here is a people not strong. They're very small. But he says, this ant here displays something. Says, the ants are a people, they're very small, they're people not strong. But he says, yet they prepare their meat in the summer. They prepare their meat in the summer, they gather their food in the harvest. Even though this ant has this little tiny brain that I've already said you'd have to study with a powerful microscope, this ant has more intelligence than many people I see every day. This ant recognizes that it's summertime. And in the summertime, I can get up on the surface of the ground, and up on the surface of the ground, there will be seeds and various other things that are available. But there is a time coming up later in the year when there'll be ice and snow up there, and none of that will be available. Also, maybe by then, birds and other insects will have gathered it. It won't be available. There's a winter time coming. There is a time coming when none of this will be available. So I have got to get up there and gather it in the harvest. I have got to strike during the day of opportunity. This ant displays wisdom that a lot of human beings I see do not display. This ant prepares in the time of opportunity. Here's the summertime, the time of opportunity. The ant strikes out and prepares during that time of opportunity. The lesson we're going to learn from the ant displays wisdom by preparation. We learn the lesson of preparation from the ant, and especially preparation during the time of opportunity. Now then, we can abundantly learn from the Bible, very easy to learn from the Bible, that as far as our being taken to heaven, that's the preparations the Lord has to make. And I've been saying to congregations for about 40 years, and yet this still goes on in my life. It's a very common thing for me, and has been all the years I've traveled over this country, to see written on pine boards in Mississippi and Georgia, and painted on rocks in North Carolina and Tennessee and Kentucky, and to see fashioned to trees all over this country, an expression that you'll find out of Amos chapter 4, verse 12, which says, prepare to meet thy God. And the application that those folks are making of it is that a dead alien sinner should make some preparations here in this life to meet God in heaven. Well, go to the context. Read the context. Take your Bible to Amos chapter 4 and look at that context. I find, first of all, that that's just a piece of a text. And always remember this, that a heretic, somebody teaching a false doctrine, everything they preach, they're going to prove it by half a text. You turn over there to Amos chapter 4, and the Lord's not writing here to dead alien sinners at all. The Lord here has no reference to anybody being taken to heaven. He says, prepare to meet thy God, O Israel. Prepare to meet thy God, O Israel. Now look at the context. You'll find here where the Lord is judging Israel. Israel is in a condition much like the United States of America is in right now, and God is punishing this people for their sins. He tells them there, and we'll start about verse 9, he said, I have given you clean teeth. I've given you cleanness of teeth. And you say, well, that sounds mighty good. I go to the dentist once or twice a year to get my teeth cleaned and pay money for it. No, read here. These clean teeth were not a blessing. You know why they had clean teeth? For want of bread. Their teeth were clean because they had nothing to use. And excuse me, nothing to eat. I've given you cleanness of teeth. Why? For want of bread. Their teeth were clean because they had nothing to eat. God says, I have withholden the rain from you when there were yet 3 months to harvest. God says, I have fixed it so that two or three cities will be wandering into one city to get water. And I come from a section of the country where we broke a record that we're not proud of. We went 77 days with no rain whatsoever. I come from a section of the country where we've not had any running water filled up ponds and city reservoirs in about a year. We have several cities in the state of Texas that the reservoirs have gotten so low that the water's foul and stagnant. And we made headlines a while back because Graham, Texas has got some big lakes around it, but we have a sister city, Throckmorton, not too many miles away, and we had to lay a pipeline over to Throckmorton because they were out of water. I can relate a little bit to some of the things he's saying here. God says, I'm going to hold the rain back. And says, you'll have two or three cities wandering over here into one city asking for water. God says, I'll cause it to rain on this piece of ground and not on this piece of ground. God goes on to say, he says, I have smitten you with blasting and with mildew. God says, I've done all these things. And he says, yet have you not returned unto me. He says, I have overthrown some of you as I overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah. And he said, you were as a firebrand plucked out of the burning, and yet have you not returned unto me. When you read this context, God hasn't said one thing in here about heaven. He hasn't said one thing about hell. He hasn't said one thing about alien sinners getting saved. What he has said is that here is his disobedient, unappreciative people that are not thankful for his blessings. They turn their back on him, and he has held the rain back. These people down here are starving. He has sent judgment after judgment on them, and then he tells them, he says, prepare to meet thy God, O Israel. What God is saying here is, if you don't turn and repent, you might as well prepare to meet me in judgment right here on this earth. There's preparations that take folks to heaven, and the Lord's made those. Proverbs chapter 16, verse 1 says, the preparations of the heart and man, the answer of tongues from the Lord. John the Baptist was sent to make ready a people prepared for the Lord. And I read in Acts 16, 14 of a little woman named Lydia, and it says, her whose heart the Lord opened, that she attended unto the things that were spoken by Paul. As far as those preparations that will take you to heaven, God makes those preparations. Yet at the same time, there's some preparations that sensible people must make here in time. You know, preparation is one sign of good sense. And if some folk back in the past have not made some preparation, I think we could say we wouldn't have this meeting house here. We wouldn't have any shelter from the elements. If there hadn't been some preparations back in the past, you wouldn't have these lights. You wouldn't have this PA system. You wouldn't have this good place out here to eat. And if some preparations hadn't been made, and if it had not been understood that we're going to be meeting here, no, and hadn't been announced, hadn't been arranged, I wouldn't be here. There was an invitation made. Brother Jeff made some arrangements to pick me up, to have me here. You have made some preparations. One sign of sensible people is that sensible people make preparations. Without preparations, the business world falls apart. I mean, without preparations, the government falls apart. Without preparations, everything I can think of in life falls apart. One sign of sensible people is sensible people make preparations. We recognize this in our everyday lives. And I do believe that I can talk a long, long time about the importance of preparation in life. I'm not saying anything about heaven. I've done told you the Lord's made those arrangements. There was a time in 1978 that I was asked to come to a high school and near San Angelo, Texas, and speak to the student body. That particular day, the reason I was to speak to this student body, about 400 students, was that it was their athletic awards day, and they wanted me to come there and make a motivational talk. You don't walk into a place like this and get up and start preaching salvation by grace. Don't get up here and start trying to push your particular belief, because to begin with, they'd probably sue somebody, and it's not really the best thing to do. Can you see that? You folk wouldn't appreciate it if the Episcopalian was invited down to your school and he got up and started trying to convert your children. So, on this particular day, it was my responsibility to stand up and speak to about 400 students. And in the talk I made to them that morning, I said, probably all of you have been told all your lives that the main thing in competition, you get out here in the sports world or the world of competition, main thing a desire to win. You've been told that, haven't you? Well, there's some of the coaches over there nodding their heads like this. Yep, yep, you don't want that. You know. I said, well, that's stupid. That doesn't make any sense. People with a desire to win are a dime a dozen. You can find people, I can find people all the way to Carthage that's got a desire to be rich. They've got a desire to be successful. People with a desire to win are a dime a dozen. Why, I've got a desire to go under the ring against the heavyweight champ of the world, whip him, and, you know, make a few million dollars. I have that desire. I'm not about to do it. People with a desire to win are a dime a dozen. There's lots and lots of men have a desire to get up here and preach. They have a desire to do that, but they can't do it. I went on to tell that group that day, I said, even in my field, people with the desire to win are a dime a dozen. I said, the main thing in competition is the desire to prepare to win. The desire to prepare to win. Now, that young man that gets out here and shoots basketball goal after basketball goal, or that football player gets out here and practices and drills and practices and drills, and that young boxer that's willing to get in the ring and practice and practice and practice and practice, or a weightlifter that's willing to train and train and train and train and train and train and train, somebody with the desire to prepare to win, when they get out on the field with the desire to win, they've got a good chance of winning. It's the desire to prepare to win. I've had a saying penciled in the front of my study Bible at home. It's been in there about 35 years. It's an old Marine motto. Right in the front of my Bible on the flyleaf is one of the strangest things you ever read in the preacher's Bible. It says, the more you sweat in training, the less you bleed in battle. That's an old Marine motto. Nobody wants to bleed in battle, do you? Best way to avoid bleeding in battle is to sweat in training. The more you sweat in training, the less you bleed in battle. And when it's a man's time to preach, and he's put up here and he has nothing to preach, or he has something on his mind, but he just can't deliver it for lack of application and lack of study, you'll see a man bleeding in battle. I'd rather sweat in training than bleed in battle. Then when folks start asking me questions about the Bible, and there's some questions about the Bible you could ask me that I cannot answer to your satisfaction, and I'm not ashamed of it. Because I don't know of anybody else that can answer them to your satisfaction. Are you following me? There's some things you could ask me about the Bible that I probably could not answer to your satisfaction, probably couldn't find anybody else could. On the other hand, there's some things that you could ask me about the Bible that I ought to know. I really ought to know if I had studied the Bible and applied myself. You understand what I'm talking about? Whenever folks start asking me about things in the Bible, that the Bible has the answers, and I'm not able to provide the answers clearly and to your satisfaction, I consider that I'm bleeding in battle. You know, I'm bleeding in battle because I didn't sweat and train. Now then, this is not only a minister's responsibility, it's your responsibility. The Apostle Peter says in 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 15, he says, but sanctify the Lord God in your hearts. He tells us to do that. And he says, be ready to give an answer to every man that asks you a reason for the hope that's within you. That's written to you folks out here. Now, the Apostle Peter didn't say you've got to be prepared to preach for sermons. He didn't say you've got to be ready to win a debate. But he said, you're to be ready to give an answer to everyone that asks you. Now, just a minute. That doesn't mean I'm going to go down to Walmart this afternoon and stand out there and start tackling people and running up and imposing myself on people. Doesn't mean that. Doesn't mean that at all. Doesn't mean I'm supposed to run up and start grabbing people. Are you saved? Are you this? Are you that? Wasn't too long ago. And like I told you, most time at home, I look a little more like a farmer, a carpenter, a cowboy than I do a preacher. Several months ago, I remember I was walking across the parking lot. Up came a wild-eyed person, looked at me, said, sir, are you saved? I said, you couldn't do anything about it if I wasn't. You'll catch that after a while. No, he couldn't do anything about it if I wasn't. You hear me? You say, well, that's not exactly the nicest answer. Well, it got rid of him, and if you'd have probably been there and seen him, you'd have probably wanted to get rid of him yourself. Well, look at this. That says, to everyone that asketh you, asketh you. One of these days, your children are going to be asking you. And the spot I'm on today, I have grandchildren asking me. And I can put up with primitive Baptist preachers maybe asking me something I can't answer, but the idea that my granddaughters are going to ask me something I can't answer is something I will not live with. I'm not going to put up with that. You talk about being spurred on to study, man, I've got spurs coming at me. Now listen. He says to give an answer. Every person in this congregation ought to be able to give at least one Bible answer for why we wash feet, why we practice communion like we do. You ought to be able to give one, at least one Bible reason why you believe in election. One Bible reason why you believe in regeneration. You ought to be able to give at least one Bible reason why you believe in the resurrection of the body. At least one Bible reason why you believe in the second coming of Christ. You say, well, I can't do that. Well, you got some preparing to do. Sorry, got some preparing to do, because this verse here was not written to preachers. It's written to folks. And if someone were to ask you, well, you've got such a hope, you like to talk about, give me a reason for that hope. Can you give a Bible reason? I didn't say you got to go home and be able to preach a sermon. You heard me? I didn't say you've got to be able to win a debate with them. But this is some preparing that God's people are supposed to do. Now then, he says the ants show that they're wise by preparing. I've had people ask me, a lot of folk ask me over the years, so you have to preach so often. So what do you do to prepare to preach? Well, to begin with, I don't prepare sermons. That's probably obvious. I spend a lot more time repairing them than I do preparing them. And what I mean by that, I spend a lot more time. Elder Walter Evans said something to me years ago I thought was very wise. He said, you know, it's the nature of preachers out here in the world that they think and think and think and think and think about their sermons, then preach them. He said, you know, old Baptist preachers, lots of times they preach them and then think about them more after they preach them than they did before. Well, I found that certainly true with me. Many times after I have preached the sermon, I find the Lord impressing me with things that give me more light on it, and a lot of things I wish I'd have said, and here's a verse over here that would have helped me said it better. And my way of putting that, I'm spending a lot of time repairing them. Maybe Elder Evans' way is the best, that we sometimes spend more time thinking about them after we've preached them than we do before we preach them. Now, as far as that's concerned, I do not carry outlines or skeletons or such as that into the pulpit. There was some folk from Georgia told me last year at Pigeon Forge, says they brought a friend of another order up to the Pigeon Forge meeting last year. And this person heard me preach a few nights and said, kept arguing them, said, I cannot believe that man is up there doing that preaching without any notes. Said, he's got to have some notes down on that pulpit. I said, somehow he can glance down at them. I said, nobody could just preach like that freehand. Well, as you may have heard, one night over there, the pulpit rolled off the table and demolished. It was on rollers. And while I was preaching, it just took off and rolled off. I was on the stage about the time. It rolled off and broke into pieces. Well, it's very obvious. That lady said, well, you know, I believe it now. Said, when that pulpit rolled off and broke into pieces, said, didn't any papers fly anywhere? No, they didn't, because they weren't there. Secondly, I stood up there and preached a long time without any pulpit. Sometimes it takes all kinds of things to prove things to some folk, doesn't it? Okay, look at this. But the best preparation I've ever found that I could make if I know I've got to preach. You say, well, that's get something on your mind. Get something on your mind. I found the best preparation that I could make if I've got something to preach is try to get everything in the world off my mind. And I've said this to God's people a lot of times the last few years. I want to say it to you. In my early years of trying to preach, when God's people would gather together like we are this morning, it seemed like the main question that people had on their minds is, will God put something on the preacher's mind? For God to put something on the preacher's mind is just as important as it's ever been. But I've had the definite feeling for the past few years that I'm preaching to folk who need to get a lot of things off their minds. And I found that's also true with me. I have found the best way to get ready to get come up here and stand and preach to God's people is to try to get everything in this world off my mind and get my mind on the Lord and something the Lord has said. That's also the best preparation that you can make to sit out there and hear the gospel, is to get the things of this world off your mind and get your mind on something the Lord has said. Now then, I have preached to a few people that seems like did a real good job of getting the things of the world off their minds. This happened to me two or three times in my life. A few years back, I was preaching at Meta Creek Church near Albemarle, North Carolina, a large crowd of people there, and some of the best friends I have on earth were about the second or third pew back, Addison Mills and his wife. And while I was up preaching in my sermon, I made reference to beans. Both of them looked like they'd been plugged into a light socket. They both jumped up, bolted, and ran out the building. And a lot of you folk out there said, well, he said something made them mad, and they walked out. Oh, no, people leave for other reasons. Just because somebody gets up and goes out, I don't figure they're angry. I found folks have other reasons for leaving. Turned out they left home that morning and left beans on the stove. I said something about beans in my sermon. Both of them thought they'd been plugged into a light socket. He looked at her, she looked at him. Didn't either one of them turn them off. About 20 minutes, they came back in sheepishly and set it to bed. Got there, you know, just as the pan was burning up. Managed to turn it off before it burned completely. Just a few weeks ago at my home church, where I pastored for 36 years, I was up preaching. There's a fine sister over there, jumps up, runs out the back. Her husband's kind of crippled. He stayed. I didn't think anything about it. She gets in the car, takes off up the driveway. Before the end of the service, she's back. Yeah, I had said something in my sermon, reminded her of something they'd left on the stove. Well, that's folks doing a real good job, I guess, of tuning the things of the world out. And maybe if it weren't for me, you know, tuning them back in, the houses might have burned down. So don't worry about tuning the world out. If there's something you left undone, probably the Lord will impress me to say something that will cause you to fly out the door and head back home, keep your house from burning down. It's important to get things off your mind if you're going to serve the Lord. Now then, I find in the 10th chapter of Acts, verse 33, that the Lord has caused Cornelius to send to the Apostle Peter. And after much struggle, and when the Apostle Peter arrives, Cornelius says to him, he said, immediately, I sent for thee, and thou hast well done that thou art come. But Cornelius had gathered together his kinsmen and near friends. And he says to Peter, he says, I sent for thee, and thou hast well done that thou art come. And he says, now therefore are we all here before God to hear all things that are commanded thee of God. This shows us a wonderful description of a mind that's prepared to enter into a service. This man's a Gentile. He's not had the privilege of hearing the gospel. He's going to hear it for the first time. These people he's gathered together, no doubt, are Gentiles. But Cornelius here has more sense about preparation in the service of God than a lot of us. First of all, he recognizes that we're here before God. God's looking down on and watching everything we're doing. His attitude is that we're ready to hear all things that are commanded thee of God. His attitude is not that I'll listen unless you get on support of the ministry or money or you go to stepping on my toes or kicking my shins. His attitude is that it's of God. If it's commanded of God, we're ready here to hear it. There's the act here displays her wisdom in preparation. And my friends, there are preparations that we need to make in every aspect of life, but what's of main concern to me is when we are headed toward the house of God. It would be very well if all of us would set aside a little time in prayer. It would be very well if we spent a few times in the Word of God and say, I wish this preacher would explain this morning. It'd be a good time if we'd spend lots of time in thanksgiving. Time's used up. Don't have time to deal with these other little three creatures, but I promise you, they're filled with lessons for the people of God. Just give you a little hint. The conies here are feeble folk. They're not able to fight. They don't have claws. They don't have fangs. They're not able to fight. So he says they make their houses in the rocks. The coney, since it's not able to defend itself, makes its houses over here in the rocks. Coney shows its wisdom through fortification. Through fortification. There's a world out here of enemies. The coney's not able to fight, so the coney seeks refuge in the rocks. There's also a world out here you cannot fight all by yourself. And you can show your wisdom by seeking refuge in the church that the Lord built on the rock, seeking refuge in the rock that's higher than I and the rock of ages. There's a world out here that you're not going to be able to fight without the Lord's help and without the encouragement of other folks that have tried to fight the good fight of faith. I have found the fortification to get through life in rubbing shoulders with and conversing with other disciples of the Lord Jesus Christ. I found the fortification to get through life in the Lord's church that I've had the pleasure of belonging to for close to 50 years. As I look back in life, I almost have chills if I try to think about, suppose I'd have tried to made it all by myself. I think about the many temptations and pitfalls to which other people have been victims, and the bad company they'd been in, and the broken marriages they'd been in, and things like that they'd been in. And the folks I know who have no friends, or else the type of friends that they have are the type of friends I wouldn't want. And I think about the fortification that I've enjoyed for these nearly 50 years among the finest, noblest people here on earth. You're a feeble folk. You can show your wisdom by fleeing to the rock and to the refuge that the Lord's placed here in this world. Flee to the rock. They're feeble folk. They know they're feeble folk. They can't fight what's round about them. And we find, and I've got to quit somewhere here, that in the 32nd chapter of Isaiah, verses 1 and 2, it says, "Behold, a king shall reign in righteousness, and princes shall rule in judgment." And it says, "A man shall be as a hiding place from the wind." Said he would be as the shadow of a great rock in a weary land. He would be as rivers of water in the desert. But what I want you to see, he'd be as the shadow of a great rock in a weary land. That's a place of refuge.